Hello, and welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and otherwise unsettling children's film, books, and TV. I'm Adam Wybray, your other host is Ren Wednesday, and today's a very special Christmas episode, looking at the 1985 BBC children's classic, The Box of Delights. So, wrap up warm and enjoy.
Hello, Adam.
Hello.
And hello, Willow, my one and only sibling.
Hi there.
Hey.
It's very exciting to be here. I'd be lying if I didn't say I had a bit of the Fantobs about it, though.
I was about to ask. You beat me to it.
Yeah, it has given me the Fantobs, just a tad. And that's a piece of the excellent slangage from our piece today.
Yeah, The Box of Delights, from, well, the TV series from 1984, based on the novel by John Masefield, which was published in 1935. And yeah, we have Willow here today because this is something that we both grew up watching every Christmas.
On a recorded VHS, if I remember correctly.
Oh, really?
I mean, I presume so. I don't know. It would have been pre-DVD. So, I don't think they were showing it every Christmas on the television.
It did get an official VHS release. So, I mean, can you remember the box? You know, did it just have Box of Delights written, scrawled on it in black marker pen? Or
I don't have any associated tease advert memories particularly with this one.
Well, this is the BBC though. You wouldn't get get 90s adverts on the BBC.
Yeah, that's true.
No, that's a good point. Maybe we used to rent it then. We might have gone down to the video rental store.
I don't know, it was something very retro either way.
What was the video rental store that your parents used to live near? It was great.
Oh, the film shop. Yeah.
Very much the black books of of film rental.
Absolutely, yeah. Vast selection of world cinema and like a few blockbusters in the corner.
Can you remember what your most kind of commonly borrowed films from it were?
Wind in the Willows. For me, I think the live-action Wind in the Willows was. Oh, maybe that wasn't actually that store, but we did. That was one of the films I remember watching most often with you.
Yeah, I did borrow with Nell and I like maybe four times from that store, and then until they eventually like you could just buy this.
Other films that we enjoyed as children together, So The Wind in the Willows, Box of Delights, which we sort of watched as a film, even though it was episodic. And I'm a little embarrassed to say The Stupids, which is not something that I will revisit.
What's The Stupids?
Well,
we've got to the secret shame section of the podcast early this week.
Yeah, I know. Oh, all it took was bringing my sibling on to really accelerate that process. it was a very bad 90s film about a family who were very stupid. Yeah. And did lots of daft things.
And they got embroiled in an adventure by wildly misinterpreting everything which happened to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a song in it that I still get in my head approximately once a week.
Oh, no.
Called I'm My Own Grandpa.
That, what?
Well, precisely, Adam. You really hit the nail on the head there.
The Box of Delights, we watched this when we were children. How about you, Adam? Did you watch this as a child?
No, my mum reckons I did. I can't really remember watching it. What I do remember is my granddad reading me parts of the book. I do remember the term scrobbling, which was a kind of common playful threat of my childhood. and I never really knew what it meant, you know? Like, I sort of imagined it as a kind of combination of tickling and being assaulted, I guess. Like, really violent tickling.
Although in context, it does seem to just mean kidnapping. Although maybe a tad more whimsical.
A whimsical kidnapping.
Than traditional kidnapping.
I don't know if it has to involve the bag over the head. that's an essential
part.
Does
seem important.
I think that's a part of the scrobble.
I think the magical flying car is also possibly important.
Oh, that's a good... Can you scrobble without a flying car? Yeah, that is a good point.
It was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang technically a film about scrobbling?
Yeah, should the child catcher be called the child scrobbler instead?
Oh, I think so, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I remember like some of the images, like Rat, and some of the characters, but only in this very vague, kind of nebulous sort of way.
Yeah. Okay. So, give a little sense of the plot. The Box of Delights itself is a magical item that can make people go small, and can make people go swift. Among other magical properties. The owner of the box is Carl Hawlings, a Punch and Judy man, who's also the creator of an elixir of life that has kept him alive for the last 700 years. But as our story begins, a villain named Abner Brown, posing as a reverend, has his eyes on the box and the elixir, and so the old Punch and Judy man entrusts it to a schoolboy, our protagonist, Kay Harker.
I mean, I know that Kay is technically the protagonist, but I really feel like Maria, I don't get afraid, Jones is probably the true star of this story.
Yeah. Well, I thought you two whippersnappers would like Creature of Disorder. Or is it Maria? Maria the Pariah.
Mariah, I don't get afraid, Jones. She's great.
Yeah, so I have a section in my notes called Mariah is the best.
Yes, she is.
She's Kay's cousin. Kay's cousins have been invited to stay for Christmas.
The Blessed Joneses.
It's Blessed Joneses. And Mariah is the adventuring, rebellious tomboy of the cousins. After she's introduced, says, my idea of a Christmas treat is if a gang of robbers burgled the neighbourhood and we battled it out with revolvers.
And this isn't wholly hypothetical. She does have revolvers.
Yeah.
Which are shown to be on her person at all times, including within the church, I will add.
She is a gun-wielding child.
Yeah.
And she has an amazing line, which I really liked, is, "Well, I didn't join their gang. What's for dessert?" Which just, amazing.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but yeah, she's, Mariah is a joy, and we will come back to her. But the villain, so Abner Brown, played by Robert Stevens, is the head villain, who's just a wonderfully villainous villain, sort of a bully type, kind of by turns snarling and smarmy. He poses as the Reverend Bottledale to be above suspicion. He's accompanied by his wife, Sylvia Daisy Pouncer, played by Patricia Quinn, who is a...
from the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, really? Who is she in that?
She's the maid with the big hair. I can't remember that character's name. Yeah, I was excited to learn that. You can see how her particular style of not overacting, just acting a lot, really works in both of these franchises.
Yeah, so she's a very drawling, vampy sort of woman who was formerly Kay's governess.
If I might very quickly say, like, as a teacher, I really enjoy some of her descriptions of children. She describes some of them, I think it's Kay himself, with the utmost detestation and contempt. There's some good teacher vibes there.
Regular coffee room chat.
Oh, the staff room, I can say, is full of detestation.
This forms a major plot point in that... she believes Kay to be such a terrible and imbecilic child that she assures Abner that there's no chance that the old Punch and Judy man has given him the box.
Because Abner, I think, reports that Kay is, according to Pouncer, an idle muff.
Is that the equivalent of a polymath? Someone who's so good at being idle that they can do it in, like, four ways at once.
I believe it's a muff, but I don't...
Yes, an idle muff.
An idle muff. Not an idle muff.
Or an idle mutt.
No, sorry. No, it's an idle muff, which I really enjoyed as a phrase. Which I get. Do you put your hands, like, inside to get warm? Is that a muff? I'm not sure. Whatever kind of muff he is, he's not very energetic at it. We know that much.
Although, in defence of Kay, he's also... not put out of joint very easily. I was thinking about whether this is scary, and it is to a point, but the thing is, none of the children ever seem particularly bothered. So, like, Mariah, you know, she's meant to... How old do you reckon she is? Like, 8, maybe?
No,
7?
No. 12.
Okay, well, even so. Okay, 12. And, like, there's a whole bit where she's been taken off by this sort of, you know, den of ne'er-do-wells, and she doesn't come back... for a good 2 days, and like all of the kids are just like, yeah, she'll be fine.
Yeah.
Whatever.
What's for dessert? Yeah. I think that I was thinking about this and their sort of imperviousness to everything, and I think it's because of their unreasonably high levels of pluck.
I was going to say it was the casual entitlement of the rich, but you know.
That too. I mean, I guess. Definitely.
Yes, they're both posh and plucky, and it seems to give them a shell of imperviousness to danger and threat.
I had to say that, like, something about this does feel intensely English. It's maybe the 1930s setting and, like, all of the poshness and the pluckiness of the characters, but it kind of reminded me of the Mitchell and Webb sketch where they're like showing, like, a Sunday afternoon relaxation tape. And it's like exclusive footage of a beef eater being hosed down with cream. Yeah, this is that English.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like Enid Blyton without all the hate, which is nice.
I mean, there's lots of classism, but, you know, less... You know.
Oh, it's a very paternal classism.
Yes, Kay is nothing if not paternally consistent. And such a young patriarch at that. I mean, yeah, like, as, like, the master of the house, a lot of adults seem to defer to him at a worryingly regular occasion. Yeah. Like, oh, Master K, you'll make all the decisions, says two adults who presumably should be looking after him.
You know, when Master K wants his posset, he gets his posset, damn it!
We'll come back to the posset.
We will. He talks down Ellen at one point for leaving the house. Ellen, his sort of housekeeper, who left the house to check on her mother. But yes. He doesn't know that at the time. But he says, "Why did you leave the house, Ellen?" Like, maybe she had to go outside. Crikey, Moses is my
way. But yeah, there's a bit when they're sort of playing out of the snow and Ellen sort of just asks them to come in. He's just like, "God, the rules and restrictions in this place."
Who do you think you are? Leaving the house, telling us what to do.
but he is willing to curtail to supplicate himself in front of authority, because the police in this are shown to be relentlessly ineffectual, just absolutely useless, and yet he really is. He has a lot of faith in them, you know. Like, every time things go wrong, they're like, "Yep, yeah, should probably go to the police. Tell the police." And then they go to the police, and the police do nothing. And, like, yeah. And then next time something goes wrong, they're like, "Yep, yeah, police. Go to the police."
And an actual quote from this policeman: "Sometimes the law has to put its foot down, and sometimes the law has to shut its eyes."
Yes, I found that rather alarming as well.
I like that it seemed to be that when the law shuts its eyes, seemed to be if a crime is perceived as ragging, which is basically if the perpetrators are posh enough, then, like, the crime's not a crime, it's just high spirits.
Yeah, he was convinced at different points it was just, you know, high spirits from people either at the RAF base or the theological school, both of which I'm sure are full of pranks all the time.
Yeah, a prank that includes kidnapping an old man.
Sorry, Ed, I'm going to have to stop you there. It's scrobbling.
Scrobbling an old man, which I guess technically isn't on the law books, so there's nothing they can do.
Looking through the dictionary of crimes. Scrobbling's not there, I'm afraid.
He loves to talk about the law, does the police officer. He talks at great length about the law and what it does and when it does it.
Yeah,
and how.
The law, magic tricks and possets, basically, is his sort of repertoire.
Strange pronunciations of words like obsession
and hex.
Hex.
Aeroplane.
Science. Oh, aeroplane, yeah. Coincience. Yeah, there's a lot of...
Coincience.
Yeah.
It's a big slab of ham and cheese acting in...
Is there any subtle acting in this?
I don't believe the Archbishop could be an Archbishop. He's very convincingly... bishop-y.
He's somewhat bishop-esque, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the old Punch and Judy man is does a lot of sort of twinkly eye acting.
That's true. Yeah.
Although that is probably it. Everyone else is acting to the rafters.
Yeah. Very much in kind of pantomime mode. Which is not necessarily a bad thing. I think, you know, it suits the material.
Tough.
Abner also has two underlings who are also posing as clergymen, who are Joe and Foxy Face Charles.
Ah, Foxy Face Charles.
Anyone want
definite
to do
a
ha ha what?
Ha 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 what?
Ha ha what? That's his catchphrase. They do most of the dirty work for Abner, including the aforementioned kidnapping or scrobbling. There's also a few early appearances from Rat, who is a human-sized rat who sneaks information for Abner and is rewarded in green cheese.
Oh, I've highlighted the first meeting of Rat. So Rat apparently appears in the prequel. Well, say prequel, the Box of Lights is actually a sequel. It came after John Masefield's The Midnight Folk, which came first. And apparently Rat in that is basically a spy for hire. So he's mercenary. He's not necessarily on the side of evil. And in fact, Kay is the one who employs him in that first book.
Oh, they have a pre-existing relationship.
Yeah. So he's quite surprised to see him. And he's like, oh, Rat. God, I didn't think, you know, he'd turn against me. But I guess he'll do anything for the green cheese, basically. So, yeah, Rat is a pre-existing character.
I wonder if Kay had much character development over the two books. Like, is he plucky and precocious across the whole thing, or... I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see. Anyway, I'll read the introduction of Rat, mostly because I want to do a Rat voice, to be honest. So, is that you, Rat? Abner asked.
Oh, it's me, a surly voice answered. And what's the good of being me? Up in the attic and down in the cellar all weathers, all hours. One who'll sell his mother if he had one, for what she'd fetch his old bones. But what do I get by it? Bacon fat, you might say, or the green of that cheese the dog won't eat, or the haggis that make the hen swoon. But I don't, my Christian friend. I get rheumatics, that, and the dog's sicked at me, that's what. As a matter of fact, I've got some green-looking cheese for you, Abner said. Look here. There was the scratch of a match. Abner lit a candle end. Kay found that he could see through a hole in the wall right into the ruin. There, blinking at the light, was a disreputable rat whom he had known in the past, not seen for years. He was now much more disreputable than ever before. Kay had heard that everybody had dropped him, and that he had gone pirating. But there he was again, and a sickening object he looked. Nah, Rat said, taking the cheese, which Kay could smell even in that cold weather. And he wouldn't give me this if he could sell it to a tourist's rest. You're right, Abner said. I wouldn't. I understand you, Abner, and you understand me, Rat said. He was eating the cheese with a sort of sideways wrench, while his little beady eyes stared at Abner. That man Joe... You better look out for Abner, Rat said. He's putting in for Chief. Likewise, the ha-ha-what man.
What do you mean? Abner asked.
That's what, Rat said.
Here he dropped his cheese on the floor. He picked it up and ate it without wiping it.
Nah, that's what, he repeated.
What's your report? Abner said.
Him what he what of, Rat said. Is a getting rid of his dog this evening.
That's nothing, Abner said.
A lady friend will take the dog. Oh, as many a dog as I've loved more than the one now lives in a watery tome with a stone round his neck. But some who claim to be friends never take a hint. That's what.
So, and he goes on.
Oh, it's a good rat voice. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Also, we learned that he did some pirating like the other pirate rats we meet.
Yeah, which I suspect is a little bit of autobiographic material from John Masefield.
He was a pirate rat?
Well, not exactly, but he did go off a sailing when he was just a teenager.
Really?
Yeah, he became like an apprentice on a boat at like 13, 14, and then went off on voyages as a teenager. Basically, and which is where he started writing poems and kind of collecting, you know, sea shanties and tales that the sailors would tell.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah, he had quite the life, actually, if you read the Wikipedia page. He was a really busy man. There's a whole section on Wikipedia about when he started up beekeeping as well. But yeah, quite the guy, and was Poet Laureate... of the UK from 1930 all the way to 1967, which I think must be the longest run a Poet Laureate in this country's ever had, I think.
Do you think they forgot that he was Poet Laureate?
Yeah, maybe. But that's one difference between
the book and the TV show. Like, you get a few of these kind of poems in the show, or characters kind of sing them to themselves. But in the book, there's a lot of poems, like sometimes breaking up the chapters, or just almost incidental. It doesn't always, like, give much rhyme or reason for them. It'll just sort of go into a poem. But yeah, there's loads of them.
So yeah, the major arc of the story is the villains trying to get their hands on the Box of Delights, not realizing that Kay has it, and in a sequence of scrobblings, first of the Punch and Judy man himself, then Mariah, Kay's guardian, Caroline Louisa, the bishop, lots of choir boys,
many clergymen,
and eventually Kay's cousin Peter,
who we all missed terribly.
I don't know why Kay kept inviting Peter on his midnight explorations when there was Mariah there. I mean,
it's a really good question.
Well,
I mean,
Mariah is a bit of a wild card, you two. Like.
Yeah, but Peter's like a foil for Kay, except he's exactly the same, but a little bit less keen to do stuff and has a more entertaining selection of words to say.
Like, Mariah wrecked the bishop's car, may I remind you? Like, I don't know what she was doing driving in the first place. And has been expelled from three schools on three separate occasions.
The headmistresses still swoon when they hear her name.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that phrase very much.
Maybe Peter is a more sensible adventuring companion, but it would have been more exciting with Mariah.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Can we talk about some of the 1930s slang?
Yeah.
We brought up Peter and... Ren, you made a very good point about something that Peter's trying very hard to do.
Yes, Peter is trying very hard to make the purple Pym happen. to the extent that when they finally release him from his cell in the flooded dungeon at the end, he says, "Well, wasn't that the purple Pym?" We're like, all right, Peter, we get it.
Oh, hi. Yeah. You're back. Great. So Kay gets sort of mock demonstrated at the beginning for saying, "I haven't a toss to my kit." To which Caroline Louisa says, "You know you're not allowed to use slang."
Kay. You know you're not allowed to use slang. There's certain phrases from this series that I just get stuck in my head, which is, then that's one of them.
Another thing that's great about Maria. Am I saying her name right?
Mariah.
Mariah.
Like Mariah Carey.
Like Mariah Carey. Excellent. Is that she calls the police officer a stupid man. Which is a very accurate surmise.
Yeah, unlike Kay, she doesn't really curtail to authority, I think it's fair to say.
Mm.
That's true. Fun. Oh, no,
yeah, go. So there's a purple Pym, there's the aforementioned Fantods.
Which he was given by the site of the Abbey, or the site of the Theological College.
Mm.
The Fantods.
I haven't a toss it in my kit.
Oh, is it toss it?
I don't. Well, that's what I heard. I don't know. I don't know what it's meant to be.
Well, who knows? And there are also some other amazing turns of phrase. It's one of my favourite things about this is just some of the individual phrases. For example, Joe is described as hot for mutiny, which I would like as a badge.
Did you two notice when Sylvia Daisy Pouncer and Abner Brown weird endearments scene?
Oh, so good.
where they're where they're talking about their plans and with the increasingly strange pet names. No, okay, I did. So it starts, my star bright Abner, my precious pearl, my blue and yellow sapphire, my emerald, my ruby, and we get to eventually my golden idol, my graven image.
That was my favourite.
Oh, I love it.
Also, my celestial one.
My celestial one. Yeah.
Mm.
He's very unctuous, isn't he?
He is.
They also really like using the possessive for each other, like my pouncer.
Mm.
Which Foxy Face Charles takes over in a rather disappointing turn at the when they betray him. Oh, you're my pouncer now. Why can't she be her own pouncer?
Yeah.
I mean, Abner, I think he's quite insecure as a villain, really. I mean, like, I think he kind of knows that he's not. For one thing, I never really understand why he wants the Box of Light so much, because mostly it seems to just make you small or really fast.
Mm.
Like, apparently it could do a lot more, but we don't see it. I mean, it could possibly transport you into a magical wood.
Yes.
Yeah, which is always nice.
You can go into the past and then stay there forever.
That's also a good option.
I mean, I quite like, there's a bit, I think in the penultimate episode, in which, like, Abner has this moment where he's like, oh, I could just retire. He says, like, why am I doing this? Like, maybe I should just take all the ridiculous amount of riches I have and retire and just not bother about
my
this box.
My rubies and sapphires.
I think he mostly wants the elixir of life, but that's not actually in the box.
Well, I think he's already been drunk, hasn't it?
Well, he was going to... He offers it back to Cole Hoardings in exchange for the Elixir of Life, which means that if he actually got the box, he may not have actually got it anyway, because Cole could have just said no.
Yeah.
He's obviously quite scared of Cole, because there's a bit where Joe challenges him and says, oh, why haven't you tortured this information out of him? And he's like, well, you don't... This guy's an amazing wizard. Like, you don't realise... No, I'm too scared to do that, basically. But I just feel like he's constantly getting a bit of lip from all his supposed insubordinates, to be honest.
They are insubordinate, aren't they? Yeah.
Like he conjures up this sort of green boy.
My second favourite character.
I was a fan as well.
Who apparently you know, he's cursed to have to sit under a waterfall. But, you know, even so, this green boy mostly just spends all his time being surly and refusing to answer his questions.
High quantities of sass, yeah. I mean, and then to which he threatens to have him pegged under the waterfall forever. which I'm sure has many meanings.
Sorry. Excuse me.
There goes our listening for kids.
Many meanings.
Willow, bringing the tone down.
My apologies.
I'm sure the iTunes algorithms won't pick up on it.
It surprised me.
The heteronormative algorithm.
It surprised me on rewatching that the boy under the waterfall is only in two short scenes, because he made quite a big impression, and he's one of the things that I remember most vividly. I don't know. Yeah, he's sort of green-skinned and sort of impish, and he's kind of covered in weeds and water snails and wearing a kind of skimpy leotard made of leaves.
He looks like he's just come out of Derek Jarman's adaptation of The Tempest, actually.
And he's shrunk.
Yes.
When he gets released, he gets to grow in height.
Yeah.
Oh, and they do the fun thing where he hits his head, and they cut from live action into something, some sort of animation trick.
Okay, yeah, so the animations here are a little confusing. the program was one of the first to kind of extensively use Quantel Paintbox, which was an early video digital editing software platform, which was used particularly for television. And it's shown off a lot here. So you get a lot of frames within frames, and a great deal of effectively blue screening effects. What would have been done with like travelling mats on film, but here is being done with digital video editing. So often the characters have a kind of faint kind of sheen around them, or a kind of slight fuzziness. Do you notice this? Like, so I think sometimes it's like they don't feel fully integrated into the landscapes.
Yeah,
which creates a slight kind of odd sense of, I don't know, dislocation or things being a bit disjointed, which might add to the dreamlike quality. Like, I think it makes things just feel a little bit out of joint and odd because, there's a lot of overlaying of imagery, basically.
I mean, there's a certain, sort of collage effect and the fact, like, when Kay goes into the box and meets Herne the Hunter, and there's a sort of overlapping paper sort of vignette effect, and then goes into the drawn animation of the forest. I find it quite sort of pleasingly sort of cut and pasted sort of combination of stuff.
It's quite scrapbooky in a way.
Yeah.
And it feels very evocative of like of watching it, and the sort of the memories of this form of animation, which also reminds me of the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe original television series, which had this sort of drawn combination.
Same production company, apparently, so that would make sense. I think it's also using Quantel Paintbox for the effects.
Interesting. And there's definitely a similar feeling in some ways between the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the Box of Delights in some respects. I can see why they would have done both.
Oh, yeah. I guess that there's this similar kind of struggle or tension between pagan beliefs and Christian beliefs, and the idea that England is a land of old pagan magic, which Christianity has built itself upon. I think in C.S. Lewis, you know, the Christianity has to always be on top. So, you know, however evocative some of the more pagan aspects in the Narnia books are, you know, they tend to be somewhat obscured by all the great Aslan is God stuff. Whereas I think Box of Lights allows for more of that kind of old magic to be present, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's represented in Cole Hawlings' The Old Punch of Duty Man, who says a couple of times that he's been around since pagan times. And Kay is, when he goes into the box, is met by Herne the Hunter, and
And of course the Archbishop meets Herne the Hunter as well at the end, but doesn't seem too fussed about it. Doesn't seem to have a crisis of faith or anything.
No, I mean, Herne the Hunter helps them get to the cathedral on time for the midnight mass.
It's a beautiful, beautiful coming together of the pagan and Christian beings, I guess.
although sadly, in the TV program, you don't get Herne's dolphin chariot, which is because there's a lot of kind of toing and froing between waking life and dreams and. I mean, in a way, most of the incident in the story is just things going wrong. You know, I mean, as in Cole gets Kay his Box of Delights pretty early on, you know, and then Kay has to look after it, and for most of the running time, he manages to keep hold of it. Mm. So mostly what happens is just various family members get kidnapped. and Kay seems not nearly as troubled by this as he probably should be.
And he drags Peter all the way along, and then, you know, they split the party, which is never a good idea.
Yeah, true. And then Peter gets kidnapped, yeah. But
Yeah, there's so there's this bit where he goes back in time. So there's some quite confusing magic lore about how you can use the Box of Delights to go back in time, but you can't take the Box of Delights with you, apparently. And so Kay kind of goes back in time to find the original creator of the Box of Delights.
Who is excellent. In an unnerving way.
Arnold of Toady, apparently a great philosopher. Mm-hmm. But who has clearly become kind of unstuck in time and is on this sort of strange desert island of the past. And, you know, his mind has become quite confused, I guess, through all this shunting back and forth through time.
Yeah, some very particular beliefs about English peoples and their tales. That comes up quite strongly.
Yeah, I don't know what on earth that was a reference to, if anything.
I had a little look. There were some like tales that like different people from different parts of England used to say that people from different parts of England had tales. I think it was particularly people who were slurring the Cornish used to say that they were betailed. But I couldn't find anything else than that. I'm sure maybe they just made it up.
So in the programme, this kind of debate over the English having tales leads to a kind of big falling out between Kay and Arnold of Toady, and Arnold sort of zaps Kay with magic lightning, and Kay is then rescued. Actually, things remain a bit more amicable in the book, and Arnold comes with Kay back into the 1930s. And they're both rescued and picked up by Herne the Hunter coming in on this dolphin chariot. So I thought I'd read this bit and the subsequent poem just because it's not in the programme. It's pretty delightful. So Kay, Herne and Arnold mounted. The dolphins at once leaped from the water, plunging in and again leaped out on the long rush towards home. Soon they were speeding level with the chariot, going swifter and swifter, racing fish against fish, while the woman called to the team and sang to them. Fin on, leap, skim the foam, swim the green toppling comb of blue seas rolling home under the west wind from Yucatan to Ind. Shear the sea flowers to stubbles, crush the blue floor to bubbles, gallop, forget your troubles, skimming in gladness the salt sea's madness. Come, flying fish, come whales, come mermaids with bright scales, come gulls that ride on gales and albatrosses that no gale tosses. Speed with us as we thrust the blue ways none can trust, the green ways without dust, the salt ways foaming, attend our homing.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was rather lovely and evocative.
It is. I mean, dolphins aren't fish, but apart from that, it's a great poem.
Well, the dolphins shot to the surface beside them, apparently.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
We were talking about animation for a bit. I really enjoyed some of the playing with size and picturing some of the sets that they must have made for like giant pieces of rag that he could wrap himself up in and a big step that he could pointlessly climb up before remembering he can fly. Some good stuff.
Big railway ticket.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I did enjoy that. Yeah. He climbs this big step with much effort and then gets swept off by a broom.
Oh, yeah. And then climbs it up again and remembers he can fly to anywhere in the house that he wants.
Yeah, my mum watching it did sort of say, oh, why didn't he just fly there in the first place? But
then he it's not cinema got... sins. We're not going to...
Ren.
Yes?
I hear you can make a posset.
Indeed I can, Adam.
I wish you would.
Maybe I will. All right. Okay, I'm going to go and make my posset.
Alrighty.
All right. We'll be right back. I am back with a posset.
A pocket full of posset.
I should hope so too. I hope you were faster about it than you were with the door.
So this is part of the plot where when Kay goes to the policeman again to describe the latest kidnapping he's witnessed, the inspector goes on at some length about how all he needs is a posset to settle him down of a night.
And what, pray tell, is a posset?
Well, a posset is a beaten egg, then warm milk, a teaspoon or a spoon of black treacle, and some nutmeg, grated nutmeg.
Wow.
And
so it's got a raw egg in it.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a bit cooked by the milk, but yeah.
A lukewarm egg.
It's got a lukewarm egg in it.
What a disgusting idea.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't help but think that the program was partly funded by the posset board.
Big posset. In the pocket of big posset.
In the pocket of big posset, yeah.
But that really tickled me.
But I have it here in a mug. And it's not bad, I have to say.
Oh, wait, you already started on it?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought we were going to have, like, a big, you know, drum roll.
Oh, okay, all right, go on then.
Pretend you haven't.
Okay.
Do a drum roll.
All right.
Okay.
No, wait, I'm doing Star Wars.
Oh, thank you. I'm now going to take my first sip of this posset. It's not bad.
Hey.
So is it?
Has it?
It
sorry.
You can't taste the egg.
Oh.
The lukewarm egg.
Yeah.
It's not like eggnog then.
Well, maybe. I've never had eggnog.
Oh.
It tastes like warm milk with treacle and nutmeg.
Is it undoing all of that learning you've been doing? Because that's sort of what is implied by the superintendent, that Kay has been learning far too much.
From
that's
books.
Why he's got this, yeah, from books.
Yeah, it is making me forget everything I've learnt from a book.
Are you losing your hobsession?
I am, yes. My hobsession is just disappearing away into this warm milk egg concoction. Yeah, and as we alluded to, he asks servant Ellen to make this posset in the most passive-aggressive way possible.
My goodness.
I don't know, to be fair, maybe, you know, maybe the child actors were going a bit cranky at this point. It might have been a long day of filming.
It might be it. Yeah, so...
You get to watch the whole, like, a lot of the process of making it in the show. It's sort of like a how-to.
Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised it doesn't come up with, you can make this at home, folks. Like, it really does feel like it, yeah.
And I finally have, so there you go.
Yeah, good stuff. And all the listeners to this podcast can now make it as well.
Yeah.
And have a... And like an experience along with
not
them.
The vegan
like
ones though.
No, sorry, not them. Sorry, vegans.
Well, you said that the egg isn't adding much, and I'm sure that like vanilla flavored soy milk.
Yeah.
Ooh, almond milk would probably be way better.
Yeah,
maybe oat. Yeah, good options.
So that was Recipe Corner here on Still Scared.
should we go into Texture of the Week?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Oh, maybe we should have sung it to, like, the tune of A Christmas Carol.
Oh.
Like, texture week, texture of the week. Oh, texture, oh, texture, I mean, of the week.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it should, shouldn't it be the first Noel tune? I mean, not to...
Oh, God, that was beautiful. How do we do that?
Texture.
The texture of the week.
Texture of the week.
Yeah.
Just like that, really. Yeah.
Excellent.
Willow, do you want to go first as you're the guest?
I'd love to. So I had a couple, but can I say two possibly, or is that unfair?
No, go
for it. Have to.
Okay, the initial one, which I think is possibly quite a strong, obvious contender, maybe, is the green cheese itself.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of that.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was some sort of plasticine they used. And it was just very green and very
Play-Doh
texturous.
Green.
Mm. Mm. The other one, I don't think probably anyone will have chosen unless there's some sort of weird sibling thing going on, but the half stag state. So this is when they turn from humans into stags and they go through this really interesting malleable drawn state where they're sort of not quite one or the other. And from a texture perspective, it was quite an interesting.
Oh, you've really got the hang of this. You're a natural.
I feel like that bit in Ponyo, when Ponyo, the Studio Ghibli film, is transforming in the tunnel and is like half fish and half girl and looks really weird and amorphous.
In between,
that's a good one.
Well, I was going to say the green cheese too, but also combined with the kind of dribbly drool of Rat. Because he's really salivating, really sort of over this green cheese, and it's all kind of caught in his bristly whiskers, and it just looks particularly foul somehow. The kind of general texture of Rat, I think. he looks both kind of bristly and sweaty and kind of stinky. And mottled, and I don't know, just generally looks pretty foul.
Yeah. It's a memorable costume and demeanour.
Yeah.
I did also have the green cheese.
that's 3 for 3 on the green cheese.
but my backup texture was the scrounger. Which Pouncer threatens to put Mariah in. We didn't mention it, but they kidnap Mariah to see if she'll join their gang, because they get the whiff of a preteen rebellion off her. But she doesn't want to. But which
is a bit disappointing, isn't it?
But the scrounger is what they threaten Mariah with, and says, "We put you in it, and it has a thing in it that goes round and round, and presently you come out as a dog biscuit."
It's particularly odd. It's not like dog meat. It's a dog biscuit.
Yeah.
Mm.
Like, yeah. How do they make a body so dry?
We can only imagine. Yeah. No, that was good. Scrubbled and scrounged.
I think generally, I mean, it's slightly rolled on like some of the language, and it's very sort of adjective heavy and sort of onomatopoeia. Just generally very evocative.
That's true. And the villains being so intensely villainous is quite Dalian as well.
Although, I will say that, you know, Roald Dahl wouldn't have let Joe and Charles get away with it all.
No.
Yeah. So I'll just describe sort of the ending of the series. So they find out that this Abner's base of operations is the Theological Training College, and Kay goes to scope it out with Peter, and then says, "Oh, you wait over there, Peter." Well, he takes the box, so you know he can go small and he's fine. But Peter just gets scrubbled instantly. But Kay starts to sneak around the college in small form, listening in on Abner. I've written, pulls in a Montelado on Joe. Come and see my dungeons. Why don't you look in here?
Oh, not just my dungeons, my precious dungeons.
Oh, yeah, quite. locks him up. Sylvia and Foxy-faced Charles realise that Abner was going to double-cross them and decide to take the jewels for themselves.
They're also having an affair.
Yes.
It is intimated.
Mm. Abner is brings up his waterfall boy to try and find out, you know, where the Box of Delights is, and the boy tells him that he will have it under his hand that day.
Which Abner is pig-headed in his determination to interpret metaphorically. Two people say it to him, and he will at no point consider the possibility that that is not a metaphor. He even says, no, of course, you mean it metaphorically.
Yes. whereas, in fact, it is literally under his hand.
But it's very tiny.
yeah, this all gets a little... Yeah, so Case sort of sneaking around in the upturn of Abner's trouser.
Oh, could we mention the demons?
Yes. So.
I wanted to have a see if we have a different favourites of the three demons summoned, or if it's all the same one.
Oh yeah, I thought it was just the demon in slightly different forms. It didn't even, for some reason, occur to me that it was three different demons.
So he summons, I think, first the Slave of the Night.
Yep.
And then. Creature.
Oh yeah, very good. And then the last one is Animus.
Yeah, I mean, they're just all great. I would highly recommend, if you don't watch all of the episodes on YouTube where you can, you at least go to the final episode and find those three pieces of beautiful drawing and admire their creature-iness.
It all goes a bit end of Fantasia.
The last episode has most of the horror, I think.
It's odd because, like, Abner clearly has loads of demonic powers, or at least demon summoning powers, but you don't really see them for a long time. He spends a lot of time not doing any magic at all.
Yeah.
Very Game of Thrones, you know, they hook you in with all the intrigue and then they're like, oh, Animus!
Yeah, so he sends these three demons off to stop the clergyman getting to the midnight service at Tarchester Cathedral for Christmas Eve. He's already captured the bishop, but he's just making sure.
I feel like for a demon, eternal creature of dark power, you might feel a little cheated that what you are doing is stopping some trains from running. So that priests can't go to a service.
Yeah, well, one of them stops the trains, one of them stops the roads, and the other one makes a snowstorm.
Just stop the sky.
He's definitely delegating.
But you cannot take life.
And he's after consulting his boy under the waterfall, he's now consulting a disembodied bronze head.
Played by someone whose name is Nicholas Chargrin.
Oh.
Great name.
this bronze talking head with swivelling eyes, which
looks like it's been sort of transplanted from a steampunk shop.
Yeah. It's very quite odd.
Or the film Metropolis, maybe.
But then disturbingly, when he gets annoyed with the head talking back to him. So he puts it upside down, where it makes these sort of horrible rasping and rattling noises, like it's choking.
It really does not like being put upside down.
And it's like, oh, don't leave me like this. But hauntingly, no one goes back for the head.
No,
not even Kay.
Not even Kay, who saw Abner do this.
It's best not reflect what happens to the head when the whole abbey floods.
Yeah.
Although, floating, possibly the right way up.
Well, we can hope. Yes. Yeah, if he hadn't suffocated before then.
Yeah, sad times.
Yeah, so poor Bronn's head. It really gets a rough deal of it.
But if you're wondering, my favourite was Creature in the middle.
Cool.
They were long limbs.
Quite, yeah, they look sort of like Pokemon evolutions of the same creature, maybe.
Yeah, that's true, actually, yes.
Yeah. Well, more Digimon, I think.
Mm.
What do you
that's
mean,
fair.
Digital Gala champions?
Yeah, I do.
Excellent.
So sort of Abner goes down to the old Punching Uderman's cell just to, I don't know, taunt him, and says, I'll have the box tonight. See, this waterfall boy told me. And then he conjures the waterfall boy again. He says he takes great delight in telling Abner that actually he had it under his hand, but then he didn't realise it.
Then he puts his thumb on his nose and gives his hand a wiggle.
In Abner's despair at having missed his opportunity to get the Box of Delights, he just decides to flood the whole basement full of prisoners.
And explode other bits of the castle too.
Yeah.
Mm.
Takes
because the bloodhound of the law has turned up. Because the police are there at that point. They have arrived. Due to Kay's persistence, they eventually decide to come and check it out.
Sylvia and Foxy Face Charles release Joe from his cell. And so I think the bishop and the clergy boys as well.
This is not in any chronological order, but we just mentioned Joe, and Joe's first line, or at least very close to the beginning.
Snow.
I like snow. and I like that.
I have that written down as well. It's it's just amazing how he sneers that line.
Yeah, yeah.
I like snow.
But anyway, they get away with it.
They do.
Yeah, so...
there's no great judgment brought down upon their heads.
Mm. Sylvia, Sylvia, Foxy Face, Charles and Joe merrily fly off in their caraplane aeroplane, dripping in burgle jewels, unpunished for kidnapping many small children. Releasing them at the end. But Joe throws a bag of flour at Abner from the aeroplane, which hits him on the head, and he falls backwards into the flooded basement, and we assume drowns. Hmm.
Yeah, it's quite a humiliating way for the arch villain to be killed, I think. Bopped on the head by a bag of flour.
From your really not very intelligent lackey, ex-lackey. Yeah.
Mm.
I was interested to learn that this that the Box of Lights is a U, possibly because it was made. And that means I could show it to my class of 4 and 5 year olds. I don't think I will, but I could, which is interesting because, you know, you're not allowed to show PGs in schools, but you can show any U's, and usually U's are more like Shaun the Sheep and less animals.
So you're saying, Willow, that you could just splice the sequence with the demons and then Abner's drowning and just show that on repeat to your child, and you'd be absolutely fine, and there'd be nothing
anyone could do to stop you. No, it would just meet the minimum requirement for being allowed to be shown in a school. I think there's possibly also some kind of discernment I'm meant to do as well. But yeah, I think that they would mostly find it boring and then briefly terrifying. But I love it. So.
So does it give you kind of Christmassy feelings watching it? Or did you just watch it all the time, not even necessarily at Christmas?
Oh.
Oh, no, I think we restricted it to around the Christmas season. Yeah,
I imagine so.
It definitely gives me Christmassy feelings. The arrangement of The First Noel by Victor Helly Hutchinson, I find very Christmassy and associate with the smell of radiators.
Oh, excellent. Yes.
Christmas radiators.
Yeah, Christmas radiator smell.
This is a shared association that myself and Ren both have, where the smell of radiators turning on is very exciting.
Yeah, it is.
The music throughout is really evocative, and yes, I think it really helps to make that kind of magical childhood adventure feeling.
Yeah, it's this lovely mix of sort of organic woodwind percussive instruments and synthesized BBC Radiophonic Workshop sounds.
Mm. The synthesizers go really hard when they're like fishes and birds. That's you can tell it's made in the 80s then, which I did not realize as a child. I don't think I really had an understanding of decades, but I didn't really have a very clear idea that this wasn't made at the time it was set. Which is worrying, chronologically speaking, that, you know, in terms of my understanding. But I think goes to show how dedicated they were to creating the 1930s feeling.
Well, yeah, so don't worry. My sister watching this didn't seem to realise previously that phoenixes aren't real. So we all have blind spots, clearly.
Lifelong learners, that's us. Also, they were in a Glee club, and I thought that Glee was quite a recent television phenomenon.
Oh, yeah, but so the police officer, right? He says that he was in a Glee club with the villain.
As the Reverend Bottledale. Hmm. So let's hope they make it all the way to regionals, eh?
I just wanted to mention the boldest claim of the episode, which is when they are escaping from the flooded cellars.
Is this a new section? The boldest claim.
Maybe it could be if people continue to make claims like this. the old Punch and Judy man turns his hat into a boat, and they're approaching a steep incline upwards to get out of the cellar, and he says, "It doesn't matter because what a salmon can do, a man can do."
Yeah, take that, Jordan Peterson, with your lobsters.
Oh, yes. That is a good claim. I quite enjoyed it when Kay was being lightning attacked when Arnold thingy was doing the emperor to him and really, really lightning bolting him. And he says, "I hope everyone calls for me." And then, duly, everyone started calling for him a moment later. It was quite a nice little bit of, you know, he was really putting it out there. Really saying exactly what he needed to happen.
Yeah, that special effect reminded me a lot of Nightmare, you know, the old TV kind of game show for kids. Where you have one kid wearing, like, the helmet going into the dungeon and the other kids instructing them. Mm-hmm. Move left. No, right.
My precious dungeon.
Yeah, kind of special effect you'd get on that.
The small side I enjoyed when Kay, when he was getting ready to leave, saying, "Come on, box," to the box of delights, as if it were a dog.
Aww.
Yeah, nice. He does, yeah. Does seem to have bonded with it somewhat.
Yeah.
In the same way that Abner had bonded with his diamonds. And I mean, the entire, like, every time Abner's on stage and is just, like, demolishing the scenery with his teeth. It's so good. One last great wickedness before I go.
Yeah.
He even indulged in some third person monologuing. So, Abner, but Abner, what about Pouncer? So good.
Oh. Yeah.
You two just want that Abner and Mariah kind of spin-off show.
I don't know.
I think Pouncer can come.
Pouncer, okay. Pouncer, and I think, ha, what? Could probably come as well.
See, Adam, it's not just me. It's clearly a genetic love of doing silly voices on this podcast. Abner, my very own.
You simply mustn't. Must not think of getting rid of Charles.
Okay. Thank you, Willow, for joining us for this episode.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been great.
It's been a lot of fun.
Do you want people to find you anywhere, or do you just want to disappear into the ether?
I mean, as a teacher, it would probably be weird if I told everyone where I did my work. So, no, I won't do that. But nice to be on here and in all of your ears. That's a weird way of saying that.
Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, who also gets special helping me make a posset credit this episode. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. You can also write a review or rate us on iTunes. We'd appreciate that. Adam, do you have a sign-off for us?
I do. Godspeed, creepy kids, because time and tide and buttered eggs wait for no man.
Nice.
Ha ha ha, what?
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.